Latter-day Saint Home Educators is pleased to bring you this audio presentation, recorded live during the 2017 Home Education Conference, held in Logan, Utah.
This is Kathy Malore with hashtag Real Mentoring for those of you in our recorded audience, and hello to the people in the mother's room. I understand you can see me. Kind of creepy, but kind of exciting as well. I'm excited to share with you what I consider to be the highest leverage mentoring tools that I've come to rely on. And it might be useful if I sort of step back for a second and define the difference, in my mind anyway, between being a teacher and being a mentor. So we all are homeschoolers, we all teach. You know, there's things to be taught to our children, everything from tying their shoes to, algebra or whatever, right? We all have to teach content. But there was a major shift in my life when I realized that my role as teacher was limiting and stress-inducing, and was basically made me feel inadequate a lot, right? But when I shifted over to this concept of mentoring, that I'm a guide, that I'm one who goes before, that changed everything, because it was no longer about the perfect curriculum or the schedule that we never stuck to. The stuff of homeschooling, and it became more about guiding my children to their greatness and helping them find their genius. I mean, that it just changed everything. So when I'm talking about mentoring, I'm talking about being that person in your children's life. And if we look at it as a set of skills and abilities that can be learned, then it's something that's achievable to all of us. It's not the guru on the mountain you had to have been born or had some spiritual awakening. It's actually a set of tools and abilities. So I'm going to share what I consider to be my highest leverage activities or ways of seeing things or things that promote thinking, and in the hopes of that some of them will be helpful to you. I'm not giving you a list of things that you need to feel like you have to go home and do them all. If something resonates with you, do it. If something does not resonate with you, just cast that aside and say, that's her thing, not mine, okay? So I don't believe in the guilt, you know, like there's no mentor guilt. We do what we can and we keep on improving, we keep on trying, but it's really about you becoming the mentor that your child needs, and I'm hoping that something that I say today will help you with that. Before I start on my content, if I have time, my hope is to take a problem that you're experiencing, one person in this audience is experiencing, and working through it, kind of a way of coaching through a problem that I think will be illustrative for everybody. So be thinking about that, and if you get called on, then your struggle, your homeschool struggle, will be the one that we work on. So the first thing I wanted to talk about is the power of mentor meetings. And I'd like to preface that with a story about my oldest. So as she said in the introduction, I have 6 kids, and my oldest is now 26. And when he was about 17, I'd been kind of waiting for rebellion. Like, you know, I mean, 17, I should have seen some rebellion. And I'm kind of waiting for it, and my friends are saying, yeah, my kid's rebelling. What do you do about the rebellion thing? I didn't have any rebellion. One day, somebody came to me with their, you know, what they were struggling with their daughter, and I went to him and I said, I have to ask you something, Adam. Can you explain to me why you've never rebelled? You're a teenager, you're supposed to rebel. And he kind of thought for a second, and he looked at me, and he said, you know, Mom, I want to be successful in my life. And if I'm going to be successful, I know that I need to listen to you and learn from you. Okay. I mean, that was kind of huge to come out of a 17-year-old's mouth. And I credit it to this concept of mentor meetings. Every Sunday afternoon or evening, we would meet. Oftentimes, it was my husband and I and our son. And we would have meetings about him and his life and his education, answering questions, relationship problems, I mean, all that kind of stuff. And it was a time that was dedicated to us becoming better mentors for him. And I really think that in those mentor meetings, what happened was a relationship of trust was built, where having the ability to come to your parents with things that are bothering you, with struggles that you're having, actually sets up for there to be no reason to rebel. And it's just been a tremendous blessing to have this concept of mentor meetings. Now, I'm not going to spend a ton of time on what that looks like. There's things in your handout that can give you ideas of things you can talk about in a mentor meeting. But I just want to point out that they don't look the same with every kid. With one kid, you might need to go out on the trampoline and just lie down with blankets and look at the stars and talk. For another kid, he's going to have his planner, and he's going to want to schedule things and ask you for the resources that he needs. You know what I mean? It's really going to be as varied as your children are varied. The important thing is that you're making time to find out how you can help them with their own education. In that sentence is an important concept in mentoring. The ability to look at it as their education changes a lot of different things as well. Because if they know that it's something that they need to take responsibility for and that you are a resource, then that puts the responsibility of getting educated on the kid. And you can start when they're little. You can just use that kind of vernacular in your home. Well, what do you want to learn in your education? You know, that kind of thing where you're asking them questions and giving them the responsibility to take ownership. Because if they think it's your fault that they don't know math, you automatically have a relationship problem. Am I right? So we need to always be giving ownership where it belongs. And mentor meetings can take all different kinds of forms, but the important thing is making sure that they happen. Another thing that is really, really powerful in mentoring is to not get caught up in outcomes. Now, what does that look like? Sometimes it looks like you have this perfect learning activity planned, whatever it might be, a science project, poetry contest, I don't know. You've got this thing, and you're going to just do this amazing learning activity, and in your mind, it has this certain outcome. Maybe little sparks of fascination, I don't know. But you're expecting something, right? And you get caught up in that outcome, and what eventually happens is you're disappointed because the kid didn't respond to that thing the way you expected them to respond. And that can set you back relationship-wise as well, but also in that learning environment because they feel like you're disappointed in them. The getting caught up in outcomes can also be a social media hangover, okay? We're going to take a picture of our perfect little homeschool activity, and you know what I mean? Like you're creating this thing for the world, right? You're kind of creating this, and this is what it's like to homeschool. And I think we all can agree that there's enough of that. We don't need to contribute to it, right? I mean, I almost want to take pictures of what homeschooling actually looks like so that, you know, there can be another message out there. But we can get caught up in what other people are thinking about our kids, and that destroys the mentor flow. I mean, it makes it so that you are caught up in what and how the kid is responding or how other people are responding, maybe grandma, right? She's quizzing them. Happens from time to time, right? Or the neighbor or whoever. And you get caught up in that outcome. I'm going to look like a failure. And oh my gosh, that insecurity does not help you in your God-given mission to raise up your children to be the people that they're supposed to be. That fear takes away from your experience because you're caught up in an outcome. You're caught up in what it looks like on the outside. Now, if you think I don't know what I'm talking about, let's go back to child number one. His name is Adam. He did not read until he was 12. Do you think I got a little pushback from people? Okay, this was before homeschooling was cool as well. Do you think I got a little insecurity going on the whole, my kid can't read? Yes, I did. And it was painful to watch him be in social situations where, you know, Cub Scouts or whatever, where reading was a thing, and Sunday school or whatever. I mean, it just doesn't matter, right? It's everywhere. And him feeling like he can't do this thing, he can't do this thing. And then eventually he could do this thing. And according to every expert that's ever walked the educational academia world, he was destined to failure, right? If you can't read at grade level by what, second or third grade, you are doomed to failure. Did you know that? All my children are therefore doomed to failure. He just graduated about a year ago from college, and he's started a master's program last month. So whatever about those experts. So anyway, we don't want to get caught up in outcomes, because then the mentoring becomes about us, how we look, how we seem to be succeeding. So this is another concept that I think is really valuable. It's the three different ways that we can teach. There are three different ways we can teach. We can show, we can do, and we can tell. And I personally think that those, in most situations, okay, it's not always, but most situations, those are the ways that order is the best way to do it. Because if you show a child first that content, right, you're teaching some content, is valuable, if you show them how to do it, then it automatically takes the fear and the mystery out of it for the child. If you have them try to do it, then they're going to learn better than if you're just telling them. But sometimes you do have to tell. Sometimes you do have to go to tell. In my experience, the best scenario is when they ask to learn. You can save yourself just hours and hours of everybody pulling their hair out and frustration by waiting until they ask to know how to do that thing. It's not always possible, but when it does happen, it is a beautiful thing. So another part about mentoring is recognizing that your child is a genius and having the mentality that your job is to develop their particular genius. Now, it's really hard to be a kid because the societal expectations for children is that they can do it all. I mean, no other time in your life, you know, are you expected to be good at sports and play a musical instrument and do advanced mathematics as well as write poetry, right? There's all these expectations on kids that are really unrealistic, and we're going to serve them better if we look for their particular genius and help them develop it and have the mentality that they are a genius. Because when they're throwing their clothes on the floor right next to their dirty clothes on the floor right next to the hamper, you think, how could they be a genius, right? Because the hamper's right there and the dirty clothes are right here. So it's hard to maintain this genius mentality. But it's a thing, and it really is something that we are entitled to revelation about, that we can become better at by observing what it is that our kids do, what feeds them and what inspires them and what they become, you know, passionate about, and not be focusing so much on those things that are difficulties for them. So one way of doing that is just observation, taking the time to observe. I had a daughter who, before she could speak, like before she had words, she could sing perfectly on pitch. I'm not a musician, but I could recognize that this kid was supposed to be a musician. Does that make sense? Have I given her mentors and opportunities to develop? Absolutely, and it's what she, you know, plans to do with her life. So that's what I'm talking about. I'm talking about not going, oh, you need to get better at math or whatever, when they may have a genius in another area, and math is going to come later. Child development is a thing. So we want to look for their gifts, rely on those, and really kind of take an 80-20 perspective on how we spend their time in our home. 80% of their time should be spent on those things that they love and that strengthen your family and that are going to speak to their passions and their skills and the things that they love, and then spend 20% of the time on the things that are maybe more difficult for them. We want to do that. The other thing that's really valuable, and I've got just a little bit in your handout, but you know, there's certainly plenty of resources out there, is to use personality typing to figure them out. Actually, first use personality typing to figure yourself out, because then you're going to be a better mentor. But also use personality typing to figure out what motivates them and helps you understand who they are. So I have a daughter that's 20 now. It's a crazy thing. And she's what the color code personality typing methodology calls a yellow, which means she's motivated by fun. Her secondary color is blue, which means that she's motivated by relationships and very, you know, high feeling things. So I knew as she was growing up that no matter what the thing was, there had to be friends and a party involved. That's what motivated her. That's where her happy place was. That's where she shone. You look at those kind of personality typings and you don't use them as, wow, we're putting them in this box and this is all that they can be. We're looking at those personality typing devices as ways of knowing. And each one of the ones I have listed on this slide are definitely valuable as a homeschooling parent. Don't overwhelm yourself, but pick one. Pick one of your children and do one. Work on figuring who they are. Who are these people that you're educating? Because that's the difference between a teacher and a mentor. We have this tightrope that we're walking. There's the desire to inspire our children to be passionate about learning, to love this idea of expanding their minds. And then we also have, on the other side of the tightrope, this need to require of them things that may, in fact, cause their love of learning to be squashed. There's like a balance there in your very nice blue dress, walking the tightrope between these two. And what I've noticed, you know, I've mentored hundreds of homeschooling parents, and this is a thing that happens in many homes. So if you recognize it, that's great. The parents vacillate between being the fun parent, we're going to go on a field trip, we're going to do art projects, to the insane drill instructor, get your math done, right? It's either one or the other. You're vascillating back and forth. You're vascillating back and forth. And the reason that it happens, I think, is because it's hard to be inspiring all the time, okay? And there are things that we need to require. So I have an entire speech on this very topic at the East this year. They do an amazing audio library. The LDSHE audio library has all the speeches. If you want more on that topic, I do an entire speech on it, and you can look it up on their website. Becoming a master of inspiring and knowing when to require things of our children is very key to having family dynamics that work and that aren't dysfunctional, quite honestly. It's also what helps us to develop the genius in our children. Because sometimes we need to require because their character is suffering. You've inspired, and then they're still kind of squatting. They're still kind of not wanting to do that thing. And then you have to talk about, well, that's funny, because I gave you all these opportunities to learn this subject, to do this thing, and since you're not choosing to do it, and I know you need to, you know, I'm going to need to require. And having those kind of back and forth between it, again, helps them to take ownership of what their part in their education is. Now, before we teach anything, I promise you that this is a fabulous tool for becoming a better mentor. And that is to identify what your no-feel-do is. When we identify our no-feel-do, what do I want them to know? How do I want them to feel? And what do I want them to do, you know, once we're done with this, right? You actually crystallize what's important. So say you're going to teach your kids something about history. You can go through the history, like the content of the history, as their eyes slowly glaze over, and get the history done because you've gone over it and then the content was out there. But what if you sat back and you said, what does this historical period teach us that helps us today? And you start asking yourself some questions. How could I use this battle to inspire my kids to battle against evil? And you approach things like that and you ask yourself, what do I want them to know? How do I want them to feel? And what do I want them to do in that process? You crystallize why that lesson's even important, and it takes away the whole complaint or excuse of, when am I ever going to need this? You guys have heard that before, right? Maybe you said it. When am I ever going to need this? Because you've done a no-feel-do before you teach that content, before you do that science experiment, before you have a discussion on a book that you've all read, because you've done that, automatically your content and your outcomes will be better. So we're going to spend a fair amount of time on asking great questions. I've kind of divided it up into two parts. One is questions that will help us to do a better job of teaching critical thinking. And then the other is more questions of emotion and motivation. I want my kids to know how to think. I don't want them to just always be taking the words of other people at their face value. I want them to be able to evaluate. I want them to be able to take content and to be able to apply it to their life. I want them to be in a situation where there is a problem to be solved and they're not looking for a YouTube video to solve it for them or whatever, right? That they can actually solve things themselves. And teaching how to think is not its own individual curriculum. There's no textbook, if you will, for teaching how to think. But if we want them to be able to do that, we need to work at it. And sometimes, I'm just going to say it, sometimes that means we need to be better at knowing how to think. So what I've done is I've outlined just a couple of things we're going to talk about briefly of ways you can do that, that will promote not only thinking skills, critical thinking means, you know, that you can analyze and come to conclusions and those kinds of things, but that you also can have great discussions in your home while you do them, that you can actually have a higher quality of culture of thinking. So the first is making connections. In our, you know, standard American education, there has been about 150 years of separating things into disciplines. And when we approach education with this is history, this is art, this is science, and that there's no cross between them, then we're perpetuating this idea that John Taylor Gatto refers to as the disconnection of all things. We don't want to do that. We want to connect things. So you can ask questions that connect things. The one I have on my slide is, how is this object connected to? And it's a game that I play. So if I had an apple, put it on the table, right? How is this apple connected to family history? How is this apple connected to philosophy? How is this apple connected to math? And you'd be amazed, especially if you get, you know, into the teen years, how quickly they're able to catch on to this and make connections that will blow your mind, because they haven't been all boxed in all their life into separating out the disciplines. So that's a game, I just call it connections, and it's just a way to, in a fun way, promote critical thinking. But obviously the same thing can be done in a wide variety of different ways. Another game that I play is to take two objects and have them compare and contrast and see what the similarities are between the two and what the differences are, or take these two objects and invent something new. So if we have a spoon and a egg beater or something, what is something that you could do that would take the characteristics of both and create something new? So it's thinking about out-of-the-box kind of thinking. So compare and contrast was next. What are the similarities and differences between George Washington and Gandhi? Just talking about two people that they know, talking about two characters that they know, having those kinds of discussions in your book. And likewise, tying a character and his or her actions to human nature. I'm a big fan of classic books. There's a lot of amazing stories out there that you can draw deep critical thinking skills from. And you can do that by discussing the actions that the characters take. You know, Shakespeare is another fabulous resource for teaching this human nature connection and how your kids can learn not to make every stupid mistake because a character has gone before. So we can do that. I'm a big fan of teaching logical fallacies because they're everywhere and because they are used primarily to persuade you to do something that's not right and true and good. So if you are unfamiliar with the concept of logical fallacies, let me just throw out a couple so you can walk away knowing one or two yourself, and you can start from there. Obviously, there's hundreds of them. One of my favorites is a false dichotomy. So I'll give you a quote. They're often in quotes. Oh, but first I'll tell you what the word dichotomy means. So a dichotomy is two separate and distinct groups. So if you look at a standard chess game, there's black pieces and there's white pieces, right? There's clearly two separate sets of pieces. There's no gray, there's no purple, there's no orange. Okay, so that's a dichotomy. But a lot of times in quotes or in comparisons, people will make false dichotomies. You might have heard somebody say something like, there are only two kinds of people, honest and dishonest. It's a false dichotomy, because even the most honest among us sometimes lie or twist the truth a little, right? And even the most scoundrelliest liar accidentally tells the truth sometimes. It's a false dichotomy. And you see them a lot in quotes. One of the famous educational quotes is, education is not the filling of a bucket, but the lighting of a fire. And I love that quote because it's powerful, and it actually comes from an ancient quote, which makes it even cooler. And it makes you want to inspire learning, right? Be inspiring. Light some fires. But a fire without a full bucket is a fanatic. You know, as somebody who doesn't know what they're doing, but they're passionate about it. So we need to do both. We need to fill buckets and light fires. So that's an example of a logical fallacy. Another very famous logical fallacy is a straw man argument, where somebody sets up an easily defeated argument to detract from the thing that they were actually asked. So if it was like, oh, let's do one in a home setting. Let's say that your kid had the responsibility to empty the dishwasher, and let's say it's a teenage girl, and let's say they had plenty of time to do it, and you say, the dishwasher is still full. Why didn't you empty the dishwasher? And she says, you know, I could be pregnant, right? Like where she's putting up some argument that was like so not what you're talking about, but then you're like, oh, yeah, you're right. It's just a dishwasher, you know, and they throw you off the trail. I'm not saying that, you know, our kids are purposely setting up straw man arguments, but you certainly see plenty of politicians do it. So learning and teaching logical fallacies is a fantastic way to teach critical thinking skills and make them better, you know, consumers of media, right? So then another one that I really love is questioning assumptions. If we learn and teach our children to question the assumptions of authors and producers of movies, like what assumptions are they basing this piece on, then we automatically are better thinkers because we can evaluate whether or not we agree with those assumptions. So you guys may have heard of a book by this really obscure person. What's her name? Hillary Clinton. It's called It Takes a Village. You guys heard of that? Okay. One of her assumptions is the village is the government. So she's taken a phrase that's true. I think it really does take a village. I think we need support. But her assumption is that the government needs to step in and raise your children. And it's an assumption I disagree with, right? So if you can identify assumptions and then question them, you and your children will be better thinkers. Another really powerful thing to learn about is worldviews. This helps us be better critical thinkers as well. I can't even begin to touch on that. But if that's something that's interesting to you, hit me up at my booth, and I'd love to recommend resources and kind of share some of the things that make that. I think it was one of the most powerful things in my self-education was to learn to understand different worldviews. And then also to search for principles in complex situations. A lot of times when we look at laws and things that are difficult to understand, we look at the issue rather than the principle involved. And like tomorrow I'm speaking to the youth, I'm going to share with them how to view news stories from the perspective of principles. And that is a skill that also promotes critical thinking because they're not just taking everything at face value and they're not getting all worked up about the issue that the law is being made from. Does that make sense? We want to be able to identify, well, wait, what principle is being supported or violated in this proposal, in this law, or whatever. A mentor asks great questions. So critical thinking questions are one sort, and the other sort are the kinds that motivate people and that help them to become even engaged in what they want to become engaged in. So one metaphor that really is powerful to understand this is the elephant metaphor. And the writer is the, let's think of a student who wants to be successful. Let's say they say, I want to get through algebra this year. And you say, okay, yeah, let's do this. And rationally they do. They see that they're going to be taking the SAT test or whatever their goal is that they're working towards. They need to know algebra. And in their rational mind, this is a good thing, okay? Well, the elephant is kind of their emotional mind. And what happens when an elephant sits down? It's sitting. You know, there's nothing you can do about an elephant sitting down, right? The emotional mind overcomes the rational mind. You may have found this in your own life, I don't know, where maybe you have a goal and your emotional mind wins out and you don't reach it. But the path is the environmental factors that you have in place. I think of that as the systems that either help us succeed or fail. When we have students who have their elephant sitting down, it's very hard to instruct because they are emotionally not there. I don't know if this happens at your house. I know it happens at mine, that the emotional state is just going to trump every other state. So we're going to talk about that for a minute, if we can see how moving the elephant is a thing that is possible. So one of the ways to know that the elephant is sitting down is that there's a lot of complaining, a lot of, you know, blaming. Okay, oh, I don't want to do this. It's not my fault. I lost my book. You know, whatever it is. They're putting their failure, their lack of motivation, they're putting it outside of themselves. What you can do is you can ask them a question like, how is that working for you? And again, it puts it back in their camp. They have to sit back and think to themselves, do I like this state? You know, do I like not being motivated to get done what my rational mind wanted? And it makes it so that you, see, it's freeing to be able to do this. It makes it so that you don't take the guilt and the blame and the, why can't we keep a neater house so that the math book doesn't disappear completely from all known places, right? It takes away, it gives you some freedom to, again, facilitate and guide and, you know, counsel, but not be responsible for that child and his or her success. I probably should say this is not true of a three-year-old. I mean, do I need to say that? I guess I should have just made that point. A lot of these are really more like your 10 and up crowd. The victim mentality is a serious issue in our society, in my opinion, and we can facilitate more victims to be put out there into society who have everybody to blame but themselves, or we can work on becoming responsible for our own lives and being self-governing. I have a shorthand for that, and it's victim card. So it's not uncommon for me to say, if I hear a bunch of blaming, it's not my fault, I didn't do it, it's, you know, so-and-so's responsibility. Then I say, well, can I give you a victim card now? Or would you, you know, it's like, how can I help you be more effective in your victimhood? Because I think sometimes naming what it is that, what the behavior really, the underlying reason for the behavior is valuable. Because if they can learn victim mentality in their own minds, like if they can recognize it in their own minds, then they won't need you forever to point it out. So I had this experience with this young man. He'd taken a Lemmy Quest class for me, so I got to mentor him for 2 years. And he went to the MTC, and he wrote me a letter. I mean, this is mentor payday, okay, when you get the letter from the MTC from the kid you mentored, because they remember you still exist, and that's always nice. And he's telling me that the other guys in his district are all complaining about having to study. I think it was 2 hours a day or something. It was some length of the time that they were expected to study. And he said, but I can't because Quest took away my victim card. I would use that terminology, so it had meaning to him. And so in this letter, he was thanking me for teaching them this principle that you're responsible for your own life, you know, and he was surrounded by kids his same age. I mean, they're not kids anymore, but they're kind of still kids. His same age, and they're all complaining, and they can't study this long, and it's too hard, and wah, 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 wah. And he thinks to himself, yeah, Kathy took away my victim card long ago, and yeah, that was a mentor painting. And catching reactive language. When you think about Stephen Covey and his first habit, be proactive, anything that's not proactive is reactive. And it comes out in our language. Oh, I couldn't do my chores. I had to go to my friend's house. Okay, that's, I have no control over my life, right? So then you just respond with, he made you, you had to, you had no choice in the matter. You know, it's kind of like teaching this thing, free agency, in a way that connects them to their own behavior and taking responsibility for it. So these are emotional elephant moments, and they also can send some of us into a tailspin when we're hearing reactive language, when we're seeing that our child is being a victim or having this complaining kind of attitude. And essentially, this idea of ownership in education is the ultimate question. Is this thing you're complaining about not serving you and the education that you want? No, it's not. What would you like to do that's different? Again, you're facilitating, you're being a mentor, you're being a guide, and that's real mentoring. There's no reward, okay? There's no like homeschool award ceremony for the mom who got her kids to finish all of their curricula. There just isn't, okay? You know, so we need to let go of the idea that the curriculum is the master. And we need to look at our children as individuals, look in their eyes and see that they're a genius and remind them from time to time that they're a genius and facilitate them on their own educational journey. So do you think your education is worth the work? It's a question that's worth asking. And it's a question that can move the elephant from his sitting on his hind end position. So I'm going to shift over to two of my favorite disciplines, writing and public speaking. Those are both areas that I feel are just so, so important because I fundamentally believe that we all have a message. You have a message. Your children, if they don't have it yet, they're developing in their lives and in their hearts a message. And that when they're unable or even unwilling to share that message, that the world suffers and that they are in bondage. If you feel that way, if you feel like, yeah, I got nothing to say that nobody needs to hear, yeah, come talk to me. I'd love to talk you out of that lie and help you see that there's something powerful in your life. I'm actually reminded of this woman who heard me talking about messages and how we all have one. And this was about 3 years ago, I think. And she came up to me after a conference session like this and she said, you know that thing you said about messages? And I said, yeah. She says, I don't think I have one. And I'd never met her before, but I gave her a big hug, because sometimes you have to hug a stranger. And I said, you know, where did that lie come from? And we actually, I mean, this doesn't, you know, it doesn't always work out this way. Sometimes I just meet people at these conferences and we have a discussion and then never see each other again. But she happened to mentor with me and actually still mentoring with me. And she's found her message and she's on fire with her message and it's changing her life. And it's so satisfying to, you know, help somebody to see that who came from a place of, I got nothing to say that's worth hearing. So anyway, writing and public speaking, I'm kind of passionate about it. And I want to share a mentoring principle here. And that is that these two skills are very intertwined. If you have a student who's struggling with writing and you pair with the writing a public speaking experience, then they're going to automatically get better at both. I've had the opportunity to mentor several groups of youth where I was teaching them in a class that had writing, expository writing, persuasive writing, and I was also teaching them an Unleashing Your Voice class, and I watched as their writing and their public speaking skills were doing this. And I think one of the reasons, this is just the Kathy Mellor hypothesis, but I think one of the reasons is because public speaking gives an automatic audience to your words. Sometimes when you're writing a paper, you kind of feel like you're just writing this thing and it's never going to go anywhere and it's never going to be seen by anybody but maybe your mom or your mentor or whatever. And it seems less vital that you get the words right. So when they're working on public speaking and writing at the same time, they are having experiences that grow their use of language, that grow their ability to affect the hearts and the minds of the people who are in their audience. And I mean, I could talk about this forever because I think it's something that's easy to kind of set to the side in homeschooling. Public speaking is like this other thing that, I don't know, we do it at church and that's going to be good enough, right? I'm going to just mention that you don't do the same thing with piano. You don't hope that your kids pick up piano, right? You put some effort into it. So one of the things that anybody can do is if you have young kids, then you can start with recitation, even just in your home, memorizing poems or quotes that they like and having them recite it at family home evening where it's just a little tiny audience that is reciting. We often put poetry with a dry erase marker on our window. We have a big, actually we have two big windows in our living room, and one of them I will use for my poetry, and I'll put that up there with a dry erase marker, and we'll all memorize it, and then, you know, I sometimes offer a prize or whatever for somebody who's memorized the poem, and says, no, nobody has to memorize poetry, but they're all given the opportunity, and then they recite it, and they gain confidence in their ability to stand up in front of people, and then when they're 10, 11, they're ready for a little more, and you can introduce the idea of impromptu speaking, pull a topic out of a jar, and have, you know, just little speeches, right? It's really funny because public speaking is a big thing in my family because it's a big thing to me. I did competitive speaking in high school and obviously teach it now. And so it's kind of like a normal thing, I guess you could say, to give speeches at our house. And I have this 13-year-old who's kind of just a butterfly, kind of all over the place. But she gets up, you know, every night at scripture study, and she starts giving lessons that she's just making up off the top of her head, or she's pulled a couple of scripture pictures. And she's so comfortable doing it. And I'm just like, this is it. This is the thing. And then when they get older, I get them in competitions so that they can, you know, have a crucible experience with public speaking. And almost every service organization, Lions Club, Optimist Club, all of those, you know, service organizations have oratorical contests, and I've had one daughter win over $6,000, and another one's already won like $3,000, so it's a nice way to beef up the college bank account or whatever. So anyway, the writing and public speaking mentoring, I wanted to put that in there because I think that there are skills that we could do better at in terms of preparing our kids to be influencers. We know we want them to influence. I can't tell you how many missionaries I've had write me and thank me for their public speaking skills because they go out on their mission and they're prepared. And I've taught them tandem speaking so they even know how to do it with a companion. So anyway, I love that stuff. So this is where I'm going to take a struggle and sort of work through it. This is based on the Lemmy philosophy of scholarship ladders. We call it VMASC for short: vision, mission, ability, skills, and knowledge. And what I love about, well, I love a lot of things about this, but what I really love about it is that it can be a diagnostic tool for finding out what a roadblock is. So we're going to kind of try it out. It'll take some give and take. So if you're uncomfortable speaking back to me, like answering questions, and then don't give me, I mean, it needs to be a give and take is what I'm saying. So does anybody have one that they'd like to work through? We'll do real on-the-spot mentoring. Yes. I'm asking for a struggle in your homeschool.
Okay.
With a particular child. It can't be like systemic with the entire. You and a child? Or just you?
Just me.
Okay, sure. Okay.
I'm like, yes.
Okay, great.
I go home.
So you have no vision problem is what I'm already hearing. Okay, so I need to repeat for the audience that's listening. She's just started her homeschooling journey, and she's got the vision. She's super excited, and when she goes home.
Dishes, laundry, tired, exhausted, angry children, lazy children. They're not lazy.
No, I know what you're saying. She's saying that when she gets home, there's dishes, there's laundry, there's angry children, there's children who are not willing to, you know, do what they're supposed to do. She's frustrated by all of that. And did I get it all?
And her
own lack of education. Okay, so she has a vision. Do you have a sense of mission? That homeschooling is part of your purpose, okay? That the world needs you to homeschool your children. Okay. She has a sense that this is really important, that her children need to benefit the world. And so what I'm hearing is that vision and mission were good as a homeschooling mom. You feel pretty solid there. You don't lie awake at night going, what am I doing? Why am I doing this? So we have abilities, skills, and knowledge left. Okay, so we're just going to go through each one of those, and I'm going to ask you a question because does the audience agree that this is an overarching problem that, you know, is not like one kid not doing his math? Okay, so abilities is next, okay? Abilities means those things that you are kind of organized, having good time management skills, those kinds of things that one can be. I'm not saying you are, but that one can be. So if I were to ask you for the one ability that would make all the difference. If you could nail this ability, it would make all the difference. Like it would just be a huge shift in your family culture. What would it be?
To be organized and see where things can be placed, to those things can work better, whether it's laundry, time.
Okay, so what I'm hearing, she's having trouble with the systems in her home. Either they are systems of default. A system of default would be something like, we do the dishes when there aren't any more cups, right? That would be a system of default. So there's systems problems in the managing of the household. Do you have a mentor for that? Okay. Do you know somebody who is really good at those things who you could say, I'm missing this ability, this organizational systems ability. Can you help me? Because, I mean, that would make all the difference, right? So see how the mentor sometimes needs a mentor. Okay, so there's an ability. Now, a skill is something that you can do. You can fry an egg. You can hit a ball. You can write a paper. You can, you know, dance the minuet. Okay, those are skills. Those are things that you can do. Skills can be learned usually through iteration and coaching. Okay, so this is kind of how you can think of skills, if that helps you. For instance, if I can't tie my shoe, somebody coaching me through it and showing me how and letting me try and then telling me how maybe, you know, I need to pull the shoelace around this other way, right? I'm giving iterative try, coach, okay? So that's a skill. What is the one skill that would help you to be able to be a better mentor? Okay, so the house is all under control. Mine isn't, but hers is going to be. What is the one skill that would make all the difference in your mentoring? You don't know? Let me throw out a couple of skills. So can you, say, teach a principle with a story?
That would be an awesome skill.
Okay, so That's an example of a mentoring skill, to be able to, okay, I want to teach this principle. What's a story I could use to illustrate it? That's a skill. It's not magic. It's just a skill. So is there something like that in your mentoring? Oh, hey, she nails the exact skill. Okay, Do you see how you just got two exact things that would help tame some of this stuff? Okay, now knowledge. Knowledge is actually kind of the least important of these. I mean, they're all important, but it's kind of the least important because we have Google. What piece, like you were talking about your education, what piece of knowledge would make all the difference in your ability to feel ready to mentor your kids? What subject do you wish you'd learned? What book do you wish you have read and feel like it would make all the difference? Learning how to teach how to read? Okay. Okay, okay. How to teach. Okay. So the knowledge that she feels she needs to do is the mechanics of being able to teach to read. I only have 2 minutes left, so you know, feel free to come to my booth and we can talk some more. But can you see how that becomes a diagnostic way of finding a roadblock in your life or in the life of your kids and the education of your kids? It's almost always gonna, I've never had it not work. It's almost always brought me the next step. So very quickly, the power of debriefing. If we have a car crash and you and I are discussing what just happened, there's all kinds of things that come out, right? Emotions and epiphanies and, oh my gosh, I should have, and right, all these heavy-duty things. So it's very easy to see how after somebody has a car accident, they might need somebody to talk to, right? Well, debriefing is a powerful environment for mentoring because it allows people to come to their own epiphanies. And by asking open-ended questions about how they felt about that learning thing, how they experienced that movie, you know, whatever it is, asking open-ended questions will help them to become a better thinker and come to their own epiphanies and really own that part of their education. And I want to end with this idea of asking questions. You can see just from what I did with this woman is that you have to ask questions to be a good mentor. Sometimes those questions are just asked within yourself. Sometimes you're asking questions, you know, like critical thinking questions. Sometimes you're asking move the elephant questions. And sometimes you're just asking questions within yourself. I've got a wide variety of them just sort of splattered up here for you to think about. In closing, I'm going to ask you to identify one of your children. Just one, because I know most of us are mothers of many, and it's overwhelming. Any of this stuff is overwhelming if you try to think about them all at once. But think of just one and ask yourself this question. Maybe think of the one that you're struggling with the most or who's having the biggest difficulty or maybe is in an emotional place. And ask yourself this question. How am I uniquely qualified to be your mentor, to be his mentor, to be her mentor? How am I uniquely qualified? What do I have to give? And just ponder on that, because when we ask questions, we find answers that we didn't even know we needed. That is just one of 100 questions you could ask yourself, but it's a specific one that I could give every single one of you that will make a difference in your ability to mentor that child, I promise you, because not only do you have the Lord on your side wanting you to be successful at this, but you have a tremendous amount of genius that is within yourself and that will help you to become the best possible mentor for this child and by extension, every child in your home and every child that you come in contact with in your journey and in your homeschooling and church journey. I thank you for the opportunity to share with you. I am happy to share chocolate with you at my booth and have you come sit and chat with me. So thank you so much.
Latter-day Saint Home Educators is a nonprofit, all-volunteer organization dedicated to providing inspiration to homeschool families. We hope you enjoyed this recording. If you are interested in listening to more recordings or would like to participate in a future conference, please visit our website at ldshe.org.